This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
In addition to his opposition to Calvinism, which he is notorious for, especially in our circles sometimes, his doctrine of entire sanctification is one about which there's been a lot of consternation among some. Sometimes Wesley's misunderstood. Certainly the holiness movement that emerges out of Wesleyanism will pick up on some of Wesley's themes and take it to some new levels, and the Methodists are going to debate about that kind of thing. But certainly the concept of holiness, which was so important to the Puritans, to the Pietists, and now to the Methodists, there will be no little ink spilt or discussion about these matters in terms of understanding how God, the Holy Spirit, works in the lives of Christians. One of the things that is clear as you look at Wesley's writings on this, and probably the clearest place to get a little small treatise on this, is you'll notice the last bullet point there, A Plain Account of Christian Perfection, 1763. That's a little booklet. It's not very long. That would be one I would recommend if you want to look into his writings. But basically, Wesley was attempting to take, he had the audacity to take the New Testament seriously. Odd thing for a Christian to do. Those places where Christ emphasizes perfection, the apostles talk about obedience, about progress in the Christian life. And Wesley said, you know, if I'm going to take the New Testament seriously, the Bible is very clear about this notion of moving on in the Christian experience. And becoming more and more Christ-like, if you would. And when Wesley begins to talk about this entire sanctification, he does make the point that, listen, I would not have a good conscience to talk about this if I did not find it evident in at least a few people's life. But Wesley says very few people reach this level, and a lot of people it's not toward the end of their life, and for most people it's not until glory. But he just believed that if these exhortations in the New Testament to, for example, be perfect as your heavenly Father in heaven is perfect, if we're going to take that at face value, then we have to recognize it may be possible in the lives of some. I've already mentioned his objection to this instantaneous sanctification that the Moravians had talked about. The holiness movement in America will espouse a similar kind of idea. That's not Wesleyan perfectionism. But he did hold out the hope that it could be something attained in this life. He recognized that temptation will always be there, but that a person can get to the point where they are moving on in grace. And part of it had to do with, you know, defining what sin is. And for Wesley, some breaking of God's law may not be, you know, defined strictly as sin. It may just be human mistakes or our own finitude, but, you know, deliberate, voluntary, violation of God's commandments, we may get to the point in life where we're no longer doing that, and that our hearts have been so perfected, but yet, he said, very few reach that that state. And it was known among the Methodists, especially as a person would present themselves for ordination in the Methodist Church, they would be asked the question, are you moving on in your perfection? And each Methodist minister was asked that. But in terms of in the doctrinal minutes, where Wesley puts down some of his directives for the Methodist societies, his exhortation was that that no Methodist should preach against it, although no one is forced to preach it. So he recognized not everybody's going to be able to swallow this. And he said, don't preach against it, but no one is going to be forced to actually preach and teach this. Which is kind of interesting. Most leaders of religious movements are kind of all or nothing, typically. So he recognized that there was going to be some different feelings about this issue. But he did believe that it's held out for us as something that we should strive toward, we might attain to. And at the very least, we can say perhaps Wesley was a little more optimistic than some should be. Now, if you ever had any contact with any of those that are come out of the holiness movement and have that kind of association of Methodism, such as Nazarenes, some of their ideas about entire sanctification, I'd argue is a bit different from where Wesley is and a few steps removed. It's almost like they're living in denial. Wesley, acknowledged that you still struggle with sin, with temptation in this life. He just believed that God may give us more victory than we're willing to acknowledge. And the higher life movement coming out of the holiness tradition will also be in that vein. But I do, respect Wesley for his sense of wanting to honor God, although we may not agree with where he ended up on that. Charles Wesley, I'm not going to say much about Charles. I mentioned him last time in the devotional and the number of hymns. He, along with John, continued in their ministry. He actually had a pulpit ministry and served a parish. He was even more so inclined to be a supporter of the Anglican established church. But you could imagine two brothers are always going to have a bit of sibling rivalry and some stuff going on. And even in his brother John's love life, Charles kind of got involved with that some, which I'm going to make mention of here in a moment. Here's Wesley's rule for Christian living. I always like to share that because I think it captures the spirit of John Wesley. Its fullness, if you would. Do all the good you can by all the means you can and all the ways you can and all the places you can at all the times you can to all the people you can as long as ever you can. And he was definitely in favor of diligent effort in the Christian life. A man who preached the gospel of grace, the free offer of the gospel, though, certainly balanced that with his sense of the fact that the Christian life is a lot of hard work. And you commit yourself to do all the good you can in your life. Now, I'm really going to have to skip over this. I only want to mention Francis Asbury in terms of the long-term projection of where Wesleyan theology and goes. And as he comes to America, but also an itinerant evangelist, like his mentor John Wesley, preached many sermons. But notice how many men he ordained in America to the Methodist ministry. Isn't that mind-boggling? Well, and that's part of the reason the Methodist movement was perpetuated like it was and known for setting up the circuit riders and linked the Methodists from New York to Georgia, the Wesley of America. And there's just a little picture of his journeys. You can see, especially in the middle colonies and in the South, Francis Asbury was very, very active and will bear much fruit for the evangelical movement in America. So the Wesleyan movement was alive and well. The Methodist Episcopal Church is established by 1785 at the Christmas Conference in America, 1784-1785, and Asbury is ordained by Wesley to be this preacher and bishop in America, and then there will be independent now ordination for the Methodists in America, and that movement will be off and running. A famous incident toward the end of his life, Wesley was definitely an abolitionist. He was friends with Wilberforce And one of the last things he did toward the end of his life is he writes a letter to Wilberforce just encouraging him. And I think I got it here somewhere. I can read it. Here we go. That's the actual picture of Wesley's handwriting there to Wilberforce. Here's what the letter said. It's dated 1791. And Wesley is now 88 years old, and this was written 6 days before he died to Wilberforce. Unless the divine power has raised you up to be as Athanasius against the world, I see not how you can go through your glorious enterprise in opposing that execrable villainy, which is the scandal of religion, of England, and of human nature. Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God be for you, who can be against you? Are all of them stronger than God? Oh, be not weary of well-doing. Go on in the name of God and in the power of His might, till even American slavery, the vilest that ever saw the sun, shall vanish away before it. And then he goes on and he talks about the injustice of laws that are unequal for blacks and whites. And then he closes that, now that He who has guided you from youth up may continue to strengthen you in this and all things, is the prayer of your dear sir, your affectionate servant, John Wesley. And of course we know the end of the story, that Wilberforce was successful there in England in the abolition of the slave trade. I want to conclude my talk about Wesley by talking about the his marriage. And the reason I take time to do this, it's kind of one of those dark secrets that Methodists don't like to talk about a lot. But it is a poignant and painful reminder about the fact that if you're going to be married and be in ministry, you do well to watch your marriage very carefully. I used to give a little talk comparing John and Molly Wesley's marriage to Martin Luther and Catherine von Bora. And I used to entitle it, "The Marriage Made in Heaven and That Marriage Made in the Other Place." But I want to tell you the story, because I hope it will make the point to you ever so clearly about how important it is that we manage our home life and take seriously those commitments. Well, I already mentioned about Sophie Hopke and his broken heart when he was in Georgia. He comes back over to this country and busy about his ministry. In his mid-40s, John actually falls in love again. This time it's to a girl in her late 20s, a woman by the name of Grace Murray. She had been a housekeeper, a close friend, fellow laborer in the gospel. He's very attracted to her. She also made excellent marks on the 7-point checklist. You thought maybe he'd thrown that thing away. But he was deeply in love with Grace Murray, but his brother Charles got involved with this. He felt like if John gets married, it's going to distract him. It's not going to be helpful for the Methodist society. And Charles Wesley talked Grace Murray into marrying someone else. And John was absolutely furious. And it really caused a rift in their relationship. But Charles did not want John married. He felt like this would be a bad thing. And so, but that wasn't the end of the story. Many of the Methodists, because of Wesley's spending time with a lot of the women workers, with rumors and stuff, they just felt like, at least for appearance sake, John, you just really need to be married. There's a banker named Ebenezer Blackwell who decided he had a prime candidate for John, and many indicate that this pretty much was a marriage on the rebound, because he had just lost the chance to marry a woman he was deeply in love with, and now this banker mentioned to him this widow named Molly Vazil. And Molly was the widow of a London merchant. She had a nice inheritance of £10,000. She had 4 children. The youngest was under 5. She had been a servant girl, but had moved up to the middle class now because of her marriage, and now had some resources. John didn't bother with the checklist this time, and he certainly didn't consult Charles about it. And Charles knew, I'm not saying a thing. I've got to stay out of this. They had a courtship that lasted all of 16 days. When Charles hears about who he's going to marry, he says, I retired to mourn and I groaned all day. Well, 1 week they spent together. She was nursing John. He had apparently injured his ankle, and there was some affection shared that, and no doubt they had probably discussed what it might be like to be married to an itinerant evangelist who's going to be gone the vast majority of the time. John had the conviction that no Methodist preacher can preach one less sermon or travel one less day, whether he's married or single. And as far as John was concerned, Molly would have to make all of the adjustments. Well, after the long engagement of 16 days, they're married, both in their 40s. John does not even mention the marriage or the wedding in his journal. The next day, he is preaching again. The next Sunday, he explained the suddenness of the wedding to the Methodist. And he publicly made this statement, "This is a cross I have taken up for your sakes." And Molly was incensed at that comment. Well, as you're going to see, as one of the biographers said, the marriage started out poorly and went downhill from there. And within a week after their wedding, he's off to a conference. He's back for a week. Then he's off for a trip up north. He would write her warm letters, asking the banker Blackwell, who had set them up, if you would, to look after her. But Molly began complaining to the banker about John's insensitivity to her needs. And 4 months after the wedding, Molly goes to Charles to complain, Brother Wesley. Charles privately talked to John about it, and the three of them met, and she listed all of John's faults and also attacked Charles. And John insisted, though, that he could not curb his God-given ministry. Charles, Brother Charles began to have real negative vibes about her, and that passed on to the Methodist societies. And Molly begins to feel paranoid. And you can imagine what that would feel like, a lot of people talking about you. Well, things had gotten in a bad state, and Molly said, well, maybe what I can do is just travel with him. Maybe this will improve our marriage. Well, you can imagine what riding on horseback for hundreds and hundreds of miles through rain, cold winter, all the abuse they experienced, threats on their life as he was doing his open-air preaching, the mobs jeering at them. And Molly gave John an earful about it all. John even writes back to Blackwell. This is, again, the banker who set up their marriage. He said, in my last journey, all my patience was put to the proof again and again. I'm content with whatever I meet with. And this must be the spirit who all who journey with me. I never fret. I never repine. I'm not discontented with anything. And to have a person at my ear fretting and murmuring and everything is like tearing the flesh off of my bones. Well, you get the picture. Molly was also known for her fits of anger. In fact, her temper was legendary. About a year and a half after their marriage, one of the Methodist preachers gives a testimony of one time going in and finding the Wesleys going at it. And this Methodist preacher records, once I was in the north of Ireland, I went into a room and found Mrs. Wesley foaming with fury. Her husband was on the floor where she had been tailing him by the hair of his head. She herself was still holding in her hand venerable locks with which she had plucked up by the roots. John wrote during this time, it is a pity. I would be glad if I had to deal with reasonable people. Nevertheless, with all of that going on, some of the letters between the two of them do show some love and affection there. Well, Molly decided to stay home, and that too caused problems. And John made a very dumb decision. He decided to encourage Molly, look, while I'm gone, why don't you open my mail for me? And some of the women that John had kept up correspondence with, in the leaders in the Methodist groups, and he didn't curtail that correspondence. He felt like it was necessary. Molly opened these letters from these women to John, and she thought the worse about that. And that exacerbated the situation also. Then there was the notorious incident with a Methodist woman named Sarah Ryan. She was a new convert. She was in her early 30s. So she had been married already 3 times without being officially divorced. John had appointed her the matron of one of the schools for children. Well, in correspondence with Sarah, John had showed his spiritual care for her, which was interpreted by Molly is more than that. And John had actually divulged some of his problems with Molly in his letters to Sarah. Molly demanded that he stop this correspondence, and she actually walked out on him, vowing that she would see him no more. And this is after about 4 years of being married. John said at this time, love is rot. So things had deteriorated. Hardly. Love is rot. R-O-T. It is rotten. A month later, John is meeting with 60 Methodist ministers, and Sarah was now presiding. This lady that he corresponded with. Molly burst into the room, pointing her finger at Sarah and shouting, "The whore now serving you has 3 husbands living." And after this explosion, believe it or not, Molly returned to John, but constant conflict there, and she was angry that it seemed like John and Charles were poisoning the minds of the Methodists against her, and she refused to give him some of the letters that had been sent to him. As he's gone most of the time, she gets these letters and she would hide them away. Well, John broke into her bureau and got the letters anyway. Here's what Molly did to get revenge. She doctored some of the letters, put them in the worst possible light that they could be, and then gave them to the London newspapers to publish. Blackwell tried to mediate with this, and John got very defensive about it, and he said, "You know, I've got to keep up this correspondence." One letter to Molly, John listed 10 complaints against her. And just kind of went through a litany of things, feeling like a prisoner in his own home and having to give account for all he did. And so both of them obviously not very happy. But John vowed, he said, "I'll do anything to keep you in good humor." Now, he once wrote to her, he said, "You violently shocked, my dear. You cut yourself off from joint prayer. How can I pray with one that is daily watching to do me hurt? Oh, Molly, throw the fire out of your bosom." Well, John, you know, treated his wife like the other Methodist members, and he basically would preach to her, even in her letters. This is what you need to do. And wives, all of you wives here know what that's like to hear that from your husband. You're not interested. She resented these pastoral letters from her husband. "I'm not one of the church members. I'm your wife." And John even suggested one time that God had sent her bad health to make her get her heart in order. But Wesley said one might as well try to convince the north wind. So he pleaded with her, as one biographer said. He lectured to her, and then he just plain ignored her. But their marriage continued for 20 years. But Molly finally walked out again, and in his journal entry in the year 1770, he writes, "For what cause I know not, my wife set out for Newcastle today, purposing never to return. I have not left her. I have not sent her away. I shall not ask her to return." Well, she did come back about another year or so, traveled with him a little more. But the antagonism among the Methodist leaders was so strong, she just finally couldn't take it. And in 1776, they split. "The water is spilt and it cannot be gathered up again," John would write. The bitterness against Molly would pass away in later years. When she dies in 1781, All she left to John was her ring. And the will said, a token that I die in love and friendship towards him. So never officially divorced, but just separated. But as one of the biographers has pointed out, John Wesley was married to his work. And he felt it would have been a grievous sin to be unfaithful to that divine marriage. But sometimes a servant of God fails to distinguish between loving God and loving God's work. And I think that's a helpful insight. Well, a great tragedy there, but I think it's an important reminder to all of us how important maintaining family life is in the midst of the ministry. It's a part of our testimony. And, you know, John was not the only one at fault here. You know, his wife, obviously, as I shared some of that stuff, she was not on board with the ministry, so to speak, in a lot of ways. And, you know, there's plenty of fault to go around. But that partnership in ministry is so vital. And I especially encourage you men that you view your ministry as a joint venture. Those of you who are going to be pastors, that we're in this together. And we're going to do this together. And God can use us. And, you know, the wives need to know if I'm married to a preacher, there's a cost to that. I never will forget hearing Barbara Barker, the wife of the famous Frank Barker, founder of the PCA, started that huge church. God had to finally deal with her one day and say, listen, and she gives this testimony, your husband does not belong to you, he belongs to me. And yes, you know, he's due some of your time, but there's a certain letting go. You've got to do too. So there's a balance in these things. I don't want to give a distorted picture, but the Wesley marriage for me has always been a powerful reminder. Be careful, be cautious, be watchful, and manage things, and know that your married life is an important part of your ministry. Spend time with your family. She's here raising, you know, little ones, and John didn't give her much attention. Estimates are he was probably gone 75% of the time. That's pretty significant. So he didn't make any adjustment, which was not right. He didn't make any. At least he says, I'm not going to. All right, well, let me see if I can just say a few things about the Enlightenment. Maybe I'll talk about the Enlightenment. We'll skip over the 30 Years' War because I want to take 10 or 15 minutes now and just say a little bit about that to kind of end up our time. Yeah. I like to end this Church History 2 talking about kind of the this event that we call the Enlightenment, which comes on along the same time of the awakenings, and where there's a major shift religiously in Europe and in Britain, which will have a long-term impact on Christianity in America and forever. This time we call the Enlightenment, or the Age of Reason, often characterized as a transition from the ancient world to the modern era. And this is a time where there's a major transition now to focusing on looking at religion in terms of what is reasonable and not necessarily what comes to us from revelation. Religion should be that which is universally discernible and carrying positive moral import. And the major shift now is away from the old classical view of the world, the heritage from Augustine, which saw kind of an ordered universe with God at the apex of that, and then you have angels and men and the other parts of creation. And now with God at the height of this great pyramid and view of the world, but now with the Enlightenment and these philosophers that are going to begin to question traditional dogmas of Christianity began to emphasize reason and human understanding and putting man more at the center of the universe rather than God. And part of this this movement now is going to play out in the church in the movement we call deism. in a new way of looking at Christianity as a whole. When we think about the genesis of the Enlightenment, though, the reason I wanted to talk about the 30 Years' War, which is a devastating period between 1618 and 1648 in Central Europe. It starts out in the city of Prague, and if you can back up the tape a little bit, back to the beginning of the semester when we talked about the Holy Roman Empire. And there was something that happened in the mid-16th century called the Peace of Augsburg. This is where an agreement between Ferdinand I and the German princes, the electors, had agreed to let each prince choose his own religious faith, whether Protestant or Catholic. And basically it was an attempt to try to tolerate both Catholicism and Protestantism, but only in its Lutheran form at this stage. And that's 1555, the Peace of Augsburg. Well, that had continued in place in the following decades. But as you move into the early decades of the 17th century, at one point, the Holy Roman Emperor had decided that he was going to declare Protestantism illegal. And what happened in the city of Prague is in 1618 is called the Defenestration of Prague. That's not a word we use all the time, defenestration, is it? It basically means to throw out, it's Latin for throw out the window. And a bunch of Protestants got a couple of Catholic officials in there in the palace in the city of Prague and threw them out the window to their deaths. And this sparked the beginning of the 30 Years' War, the major battle at White Mountain between the Catholic and Protestant forces. You had a Protestant League and a Catholic League that began to be organized, and they are going to have conflict now over the next three decades. The King of Denmark's going to get involved, the King of Sweden, the French are going to get involved in the later stages of that, the Lutheran princes, there's pressure on England to send troops over to support the Protestant cause. But the long and short of it, at the end of the day, in 1648, when the Peace of Westphalia is signed, basically things have not changed from where they were in 1555. After all of this bloodshed, hundreds of thousands of people killed, the devastation across Central Europe was horrible in terms of the famine, the sickness, the slaughter of people. And quite frankly, a lot of the people in Europe were just fed up with this religious controversy, and many of them among the intellectuals thought, well, if this is what Christianity leads to, we're not sure we want any more of that. The French Revolution in the following century is going to play out, which is in its infamous enthronement of reason, the goddess of reason in place of God. We're going to turn to human reason. And those that wanted to keep some kind of semblance of religious thought began to turn toward deism, with this understanding, well, there's certain basic truths we can discern from nature and that are reasonable about religion, but certainly we cannot accept the dogmas that have been passed on down by tradition in the church. That these things do not meet the criteria of rationality. And deism was rather diverse, but among some of the early deists that would come out of the Enlightenment period, they acknowledged, you know, a divine creator. Many of them talked about the human life being immortal and believed that that it was reasonable to expect that there would be rewards and judgment in the next life. But other than that, that was some of the basic principles that they surmised that they could discern from the use of a reason and obvious from creation. So on the religious side, you've got that going on. And in the scientific area, you've got men like Isaac Newton and Galileo. Galileo, you remember, challenges the old view of the Earth as the center of the universe. He picks up on Copernicus's idea that no, the sun is the center of the universe. What we've been able to discern through observing the stars and the planets is that indeed the sun is the center. And then in 1566, Galileo has his famous trial where he is before the whole Roman Curia there, and he's found guilty. He stays in good stead with the Roman Catholic Church, and even though he finally submits and agrees that, I will not teach this idea, he really continues to maintain it, and toward the end of his life is even given permission to write about these ideas again. But a long controversy around Galileo and then Isaac Newton's contributions in science, or many of the other scientists we could point to during this period of the 17th and 18th century Enlightenment. Then on the philosophical side, you've got men like René Descartes, who is also wanting to highlight the human innate ability to reason, and that man now becomes his own test of authority in reality. If you look at kind of the big picture on this, if you talk about the transitions historically, if the Roman Catholic Church, the medieval church, if its primary source of authority was tradition, and you think about the Reformation era, its primary source of authority being Scripture, now the primary source of authority for modern man coming out of the Enlightenment era, in this modern period, is reason. And really, in many ways, completing the transition to the modern era that had begun at the time of the Renaissance. If you recall, we had talked about some of the Renaissance scholars had begun to talk about man being the measure of all things. And so philosophically, scientifically, religiously, the world is changing. Now, the bookend on the Enlightenment, on one end, we talk about the philosophy and theology of Immanuel Kant, because Kant, toward the end of the 18th century, in 1799, is going to publish his book, The Critique of Pure Reason. And Kant is going to try to carve out some middle ground from a pure rationalism, which seemed to be the main thrust of the Enlightenment movement, versus a traditional religionist who continued to look at revelation. Kant is going to try to carve out a unique area for religion, the moral realm, which is going to influence the development of modern theology very significantly in Germany, in men like Schleiermacher. And so the Enlightenment era, as it unfolds in the 17th and 18th century now, is going to be a major shift historically, and a real challenge for Christianity. And as we think about our own country, just to give you an idea of how these things were going on simultaneously, 1740s, the peak of the Great Awakening in this country, moving in the next few decades toward independence, were who are some of the most prominent leaders in America at this time, but deists like Thomas Jefferson. See, the Enlightenment was alive and well at the time of the founding of our nation. And Jefferson always liked to refer to himself as a Christian. But indeed, he had jettisoned much of traditional Christianity. He did not accept the deity of Christ. He thought Christ was a great moral teacher. And he was all about the basic ethical principles of Christ being a part of the moral fiber of the Republic, if you would, but very much opposed to traditional Christianity. And so along with that deist influence, which comes into this country from the continent, you've also got the awakening going on. And so you've got these competing wings within the church. In New England, some of the Congregationalists are eventually going to become Unitarian, which is similar to some of the deistic ideas, and then on up to the modern tension between evangelicals and liberals in the church today, much of this being born out of the time of the Pietist renewal and then the Enlightenment, on the liberal theology beginning really at the time of the Enlightenment, some of those basic principles, wanting to hold on to a form of religion, as St. Paul says, but denying the power of it and undermining traditional Orthodox Christianity. And I guess the sobering idea of this is within 150 to 200 years of the great reform movement that Luther had started, there began to be a very serious exodus from Orthodox Christianity. So again, you know, the renewal, the cycle of renewal will take place, and but yet these modernist ideas, which are birthed in the Enlightenment and are given more fruit in the later German higher critical studies and in German theology, will change the face of Christianity, and we're still fighting those battles today.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.